I'm in trouble, what do I do? And they're being referred to the local branch office or Salem Central or some ways for collection. So also they're, if I understand correctly, they're also carrying lists of our foreclosed properties for interested buyers and so on and so forth. And these are in, if I remember right, 30 of the 36 counties?
30.
So 30, yeah, so we're getting quite a, you know, quite a coverage out of these people, out of 30 veteran service officers.
Now, how does that answer Senator Wire's question?
And he asked me if we were, I'm sorry.
How does it help them to pay back or to pay into the loan fund or make their loan?
I guess what he's saying is if they have somebody to counsel with, they're more apt to be able to get
their
grids together.
And the other thing that they do, too, is they do supply some counseling also as far as federal benefits and helping with applications, federal benefits, referring them to our counseling section and et cetera. So they're kind of the field liaison between the veteran in the field and this, in the agency.
John? Mr. Chairman, County Veteran Service Officer's primary role since that program was established years ago has been working with veterans and survivors and obtaining federal benefits. But the department, not all that many years ago, worked with those people and kept them up to date and trained on the home loan program and the problems. And during the 70s, which I guess you would call the growth years of the department, these people were more and more excluded from the state side of the program, still very much involved on the federal side. But during the last couple of years, our operations people have been providing training, trying to get them back in tune to what we're doing and trying to do so that we don't have offices all over the state, and as a result of this, we'll have even less. But to make that contact, the people, they'll know the people, you know, that will have the answers if there is a problem in that. And we spent a good deal of time at these training sessions for the veteran service officers regarding loan program and collections, delinquencies, foreclosures, and state-owned properties.
As I said, Mr. Chairman, the figure is a little higher in this, in anticipation of Tillamook County coming in, although we don't have any certainty about that, and I suppose that's our main reason for saying to you that $620,000 might be the way you want to start out. Remember that these are now going to be general fund expenditures, or half of them will be general fund expenditures in this biennium. So anyway, the difference between what's in the LFO column and the governor's rec is the uncertainty over Tillamook County being a part of the program. Vet service office, service organizations, the governor's recommendation anticipated either one or two new vet service organizations coming into the program. In talking with the department, it appears that that's not going to happen, and the figure of $198,000 in the LFO column is the department's best estimate of what would be necessary to continue the vets organizations. And I believe we've got five of them. Is that right?
Five
at the present. So we're just going.
This comes out of the 1.4.
Yes, sir.
That we talked about yesterday.
Yes.
It's just to switch over, but this is a more detailed description.
The education program, the governor has recommended $22,000, and it's my understanding now, and Gary Van Horn can talk to you about this, but it's my understanding now that that is going to be general funded in the governor's recommendation. I don't have anything in the column for my LFO, because at the time I put your estimates together, I wasn't sure where we were going to be on education, what was actually being recommended. Frankly, it's a pretty iffy program in terms of numbers of people benefiting. You spend $20,000 on approximately 53 people over a biennium. There were, I think it was 53 unduplicated headcount in the current biennium that got educational benefits from the program.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, well, those figures don't add up over there. All those programs are out of that. You got general fund down there, $409,000.
Yeah,
more than that.
It's half. Representative Jones, Mr. Chairman, we are
only talking about one year.
No, sir. The the governor's recommendation is to begin to general fund these programs in the second year of the biennium. So I've divided the totals equally. And I don't know what to suggest you on the education program. As I say, I think it has marginal benefit when you look at the number of people that are assisted by this program. And it seems like you really have to ask a hard question, do we want to consider a program that serves only 53 people in a biennium?
The other thing is the attorney.
Yes, sir.
That's coming next.
There is nothing in the governor's budget for the attorney program, and I understand from Gary Van Horn that they are now going to recommend a repeal of the legislation for the attorney assistance program. So I have not included it. If you wanted to do that.
No.
So, Mr. Van Horn.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, your staff is correct. The governor's office did get together with us yesterday and today, and we are authorized to say that we would continue supporting the educational aid program with the general fund, and we would recommend repeal of the attorney assistance program, and we've provided that language to your staff.
Okay. Now, someone try to defend the educational program.
The educational aid program, first historically, was developed almost immediately after World War II. It was a program that was very helpful. It was immediately followed by the federal GI Bill of Rights. And at that time, those people that were involved in the state ed moved over to the federal because you couldn't duplicate. It was a little bit of non-use there until the years between World War II and Korea. Received heavy use, and then after the Korean War, and they had used their GI bills. During recent years, after the beginning of the Vietnam conflict, the educational program received another boost in the number of people using the program, but was limited to guys who actually were in country. Those who had received the Expeditionary Medal or the Service Medal. New GI Bill came through, which has been extended and grown on, so limited use of the educational aid program. And during the last few years, primarily, it's been used by people who are required to go back and update skills, such as school teachers and that, in order for certification and that. There are, Cheryl Lamar here, probably tell you more about the type of persons, but when I was working in that division, that's who you primarily dealt with, or a person who went to a community college and picked up a job skill. The use is down, and has been down for a number of years.
Was Gary's number of 53 close?
That's probably right on target.
Exactly. That number.
Hope so, Mr. Chairman. I got it from the department.
Yes.
No, sir.
So there's 53 people out there, most of whom are likely teachers. Maintaining their certification is no.
This is Cheryl Lamar. She's the Assistant Administrator of the Veterans Services Division.
Are any of these people constituents of any member of this subcommittee?
We could be.
Yes, they probably are.
If you want us to move.
Yes.
Okay.
The educational aid program is used for teaching certification and that type of thing, but a little over half of the people who use it right now are vocational users, changes in jobs and that type of thing.
Like retraining?
Retraining, right. Areas like it kind of goes with the economy of the state, if mills close and that type of thing.
Why don't we leave this alone, Mr. Weiss? Go right along with the governor's recommended. Okay. So, thank you.
All right, Mr. Chairman, then if you'd put the $22,566 back in, then you'll have a proportionate increase in general and other fund, about $11,000 more in general fund than other fund would be what you'd be looking at. And I'm assuming that you are comfortable with the assumption that until Tillamook County comes in,
yes,
you ought not to appropriate money for it. And I believe I'm right that the $198,000 for the vets organizations is the figure that I got from the department that's sufficient to maintain the existing vets organization program. If not, correct me, John.
Mr. Chairman, Gary Weeks, yes, that's correct. If another organization met the qualification and applied for participation, those dollars would just have to be scaled down to meet six organizations as opposed to five.
But we're giving an increase. Okay. Okay. That's where we are then.
Mr. Chairman, you need to take some kind of action on the governor's recommendation then on the attorney services program, whether you'd want to include his language to repeal that program or you'd like to see it continued with either general or sinking fund revenues.
Well, I'm inclined to follow the governor's lead here on these two programs.
Perhaps, Mr. Chairman, perhaps it'd be helpful for me to tell you a little bit of information that I got from the department. And since that program came about through the last biennium and after the emergency board appearance, I understand there have been 63 vets that applied for some kind of legal assistance from that, from the program. 49 of those have been referred to two attorneys. Of that 49, 12 had cases that were closed because apparently the disability didn't qualify or it wasn't incurred in combat for whatever reason. I'm not entirely certain. So the remaining individuals then had some claims that were processed. The expected cost is going to be around $20,000 for the current biennium.
Well, my assumption is, when I made that statement, that I'm into being a rubber stamp. It's just that I'm assuming, because of the length of time that it's taken for governor's recommendations to come forward, that there has been quite a bit of thought given these two programs, more thought than we've been giving it in the few minutes we've been discussing them. Am I correct in that assumption? There's been some input from
Mr. Van Horn can answer probably more, but I first discussed our budget and these programs specifically with the governor early on in January. Education program, is very supportive of education, especially the way the economics are today in Oregon, the number of people losing jobs. The attorney assistance program, he asked me, what is it? Why do you have it? Well, we have it. Federal law, most veteran benefits are provided by the feds.
Yes.
Federal law prevents a veteran from hiring an attorney and prosecuting his claim, with the VA or taking the VA to court unless the attorney is willing to settle for $10. Now, this has been a bone of contention with veterans organizations for a long time. This program was developed as they thought that the system could be moved around where you could get, private legal representation for that veteran as he fights the federal government, for benefits that, he believes he's rightfully entitled to. Well, it didn't solve the problem. The problem still exists at the federal level mm-hmm. with the statutory limitations, and there is, and Senator Wire is probably much more familiar with it, but there are a number of bills in the Congress in recent sessions to provide for due process, veterans benefits, or judicial review. And most of your national veterans organizations, like the guy that was here yesterday, Carl, the organizations that he represents and works with, they really done 180 degrees where they've come around and they support a change at the federal level. I would hope, to, like to think, that the federal Congress would act upon that, you know, this Congress in providing, removing that $10 fee limitation and providing for judicial review after the claim has moved through the appellate process within the VA system. Yeah. And I think that's achievable. Our program, it's helpful, it's limited. What was financed this last year was a test program, you know, for 20-some thousand dollars. What we had asked for was an ad package of $153,000 to put this around the state so all people are comfortable. I mean, yeah. It's available to all people. County service officers still channel requests into us as it is, but it's another one of those things that it's in Salem and it's nowhere else.
Okay, so, and the governor's put zero in the budget, certainly no effort to put enough in to help the whole population who might be eligible for this, and so is very, very selective indeed. What I would recommend the subcommittee do then is to accept the governor's budget recommendations, then go ahead and introduce or recommend to the full committee that the measure be introduced at the request of the governor or the executive department, I'm not sure which.
The governor's office.
At the request of the governor, and see what happens. Okay. Then, are we ready to take action on this?
You're getting close.
Okay.
A couple other things that you should be aware of. There, I think the department has some interest in or projects that they may sell additional refunding bonds beyond what's in the budget here. And the budget includes $200 million
in
for
current
the
refunding authority.
And I think you ought to get something on the record about their plans for that.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, in December 1985, the department sold $740 million of variable rate demand bonds. They were variable with a provision written into the contract that these variable rate bonds are convertible to fixed rate. Now, one of the recommendations of the task force when they looked at us early on in the year was fix the variable rate debt. Well, through the notification procedure, 45 days prior notice, we can fix that debt. Some of it, you know, is turning every 7 days, some of it every 6 months, and part of it annually. As long as we go through this procedure that's outlined in the contract, we can convert that. A suggestion was made by our financial advisor that it may be more advantageous to the state of Oregon, instead of going through the this conversion process, mm-hmm. where you'd be aiming at a target date, that you refund these bonds, much as we've done this advance refunding where the market started going haywire on us. And every day there were a couple of conference calls, we were talking about the market, and you would have a period of time to look at for the best rate for the state. That's what Gary is referring to, and it's a technique that may be more advantageous to the state. It hasn't been fully you know, explored at this time. Bill Henderson is here, our finance director. You know, they could talk some about this, but you know, one of the you know, variable rate debt performs very well for our department. But as time goes by, our cash goes away, and then you're at risk. Fixing the debt, you know, prevents rates from taking off and running away from you, and no money in the bank. There's the technique that's built into the contract. There's this other technique that's been suggested by Smith, Barney, Harrison, Upton, who are our financial advisors. and, you know, which one would be used, that would remain to be seen, but, you know, they're both addressing the issue and the protection of the state and the department, you know, during this process of fixing it from variable to a fixed rate debt.
Gary.
$200 million, Mr. Chairman, doesn't appear as a non-limit expenditure. It's a revenue, right? I'm not getting the two. There's refunding and advanced refunding bonds in here. The advanced refunding bonds are the $300 million?
$300 million of advanced refunding authority was there, and...
And the $200 million only shows up as a revenue. It doesn't show up as an expenditure.
Where does it show up?
One of them isn't in there, Mr. Chairman, I believe. Maybe we better get Mr. Henderson up.
He's in charge of our sleight of hand program.
One of these is not in the budget.
Right, I understand that.
So that's the reason why you don't see the piece of it. It's replacing existing.
It's a sleight of hand. That's different than showing from yours, but not much.
Not much.
Both the current refunding and the advance refunding, or any refunding technique, is you're actually replacing debt as opposed to, you know, paying that debt off. And it was used as a technique in restructuring when the department was going to go into the red, I suppose in 1990, about 2000, and the understanding of the conversion process. Bill Henderson, Assistant Director for Finance.
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Henderson, Assistant Director of Finance for the Department. And apparently there may have been some subsequent discussions to when I was involved in this, but current refundings, refund debt becomes due within the next 90 days. And then my initial involvement in the bond dollars that flow through our budget assume that a current refunding would not only be a revenue item but also an expenditure item. Otherwise, your bottom line numbers don't work out. So there may have been some adjustments made, but you can't have hundreds of millions flowing in the revenue end without the same hundreds of millions disappearing on the expenditure side for debt service or whatever without the bottom line number going haywire. That's why my comment to you was that the expenses are in there somewhere. Now, they're either netted out or they're shown on line items as debt service, but they're in there, believe me.
All right.
Representative Jones.
Yeah, well, I thought you mentioned 231 ways from now, a refund bonds. There's nothing on this sheet, and then the advanced refund bonds is 300.
That's my problem. There are $500 million of two different flavors of refunding bonds. One refunding, one advanced refunding. And from the information that I got from the department, $300 million of it is in their non-limited. Now, I don't know where the $200 million is. That's what we're trying to pin down.
I think if we go back and look at the numbers, it'd probably go the other way. The advanced refunding,
these are your numbers, so.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Mr. Renhorn.
During development of the governor's recommended budget and in the detail for the various decision units that I provided earlier, there were several definitional changes from the agency request. And I think your staff has clarified a number of others. The problem we have in working through these is to try and, for bond counsel and underwriter review purposes, make the agency budget appear to be similar to the state or the agency financial statement that is used for bond sales. Unfortunately, the budget accounting is not the same, and trying to make that document show the things that they want to show to the bond buyers and sellers doesn't work very well, and it needs some more work.
Got it. Why don't we then go ahead and take action on the operating budget of the department, which we understand very thoroughly, mm-hmm. and we'll have to set this aside because we cannot let a budget that's a few hundred million off out. You understand?
I understand.
Mr. Henderson.
Mr. Chairman, the flow-through question here, I'm not sure why that's coming up as a question, but the basic question that we're bringing to you at this point is that should we choose to use the current refunding technique to change from variable rate debt to fixed rate uh-huh. debt would require the issuance of current refunding bonds. Those have to be shown in the budget, and we only have $200 million of current refunding bonds in the budget, and we therefore need to set another $740 million added to that number, or at least as a budget note. In other words, if we want to switch $740 million from a variable rate mode and use the current refunding technique to do that, we only have a line item in our budget that says $200 million. That was my understanding, that somebody has to say, well, go ahead and use the current refunding approach for $740 if you want to, and here's the authority to do so. So that's kind of the question we're bringing to you.
And we're going to think about that.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think as much as it'd be nice to finish this, there isn't any line item for $200 million. It's not there. It's there in your revenue, but it's not there in your expenditures.
Correct.
It's not easily seen. We'll have to dig it out.
Well, I went through it. I mean, there's no line item that's going to show up. It's just not there.
So, Mr. Chairman, it'd probably only take a bit to come back once we've had a chance to look this over. Mm-hmm. Figure out for you, and whether you want to add $700 million to the governor's recommendation is, if it's a non-limited,
it's not.
It'd be nice to have it be there to start with, and then if they want to go up from it, that's possible. Your budget report could show that you had some discussion about it.
Oh, I'm trying this.
This is prudent management is what they're asking you for authority for.
What is that? What did you say?
Prudent management. If they determine that they can improve the status of the, they're asking you.
By the change in the interest rate, either variable or fixed, or if there is some bonds come due, and they're 20 years and their loan's 40, then there's got to be. Would this be part of that area, refunding of those types of bonds?
I think so. Ms. Bill, I think, can give you.
Mr. Chair, John gave you one example of why the refunding technique might be used, and that's timing the market. It gives us more flexibility in getting into the market. Another example would be the variable rate bonds, the $740 million that are currently outstanding, have what we call bullet maturities. They're out there 30 years, and they have big chunks that mature. Uh-huh. When we get ready to go into the fixed mode, if we just use the conversion process, we convert to that bullet maturity. We may want to use the current refunding technique in order to set up a serial maturity that maybe 2 years from now we decide blends better with our overall debt structure and stuff. And so it's just a much more flexible technique to use when the time comes. You know, whether that comes next week or 2 years from today, I don't know. But I think the recent advice from our FAs to provide that flexibility is good advice. So,
do you make any annual payments on the principal on bonds?
Not on these variable rate bonds, Mr. Chairman.
Or any other kind of bonds. In other words, when they come due, it's all due.
Mr. Chairman.
The money that you've collected over the years to pay them off is square.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jones, we do. In our annual debt service, we pay both principal and interest on bonds, some of the bonds maturing each year, in fact, each 15 days.
So if things work like
structured and spread it out.
Oh, that's another deal. That's a new deal. But it's based on the program at the time. If you make your annual payment, same as I have to do on one of them, but at the end of the amortization period, they would be, you would have paid on escrow. But the 40-year loans against a 20-year bond don't seem to work too well, so I hope that's reading you have to refinance.
That was one of the major problems that faced us when we started out on this 2 years ago, was it was a mismatch of a short bond, a long loan, and the fact that we subsidized the loans in the late 70s.
Yes.
From sound management practice, then do you have a choice, Mr. Chairman?
No, we need the numbers in the budget, and we need for exec to have the opportunity to review it and put it together properly.
Well, I'm not concerned. Personally, I'm not concerned about this because I simply see that we don't have a choice, and the rest of it we've already been through. So
I don't have a problem with it either. It's just that we do need the numbers generated. I think we've taken action. We understand that we're going to allow this kind of flexibility. We know what we're going to do. We are absent a senator. This will give Gary an opportunity.
Giving it department status. No question about that. And that in itself is a change that some people would cite as important. When you solve another problem at Commerce, Financial Institutions Division problem, which you've heard me on before, and you create a merger there so you can have some cross-training and consolidated staffs and make the about $1 million worth in cuts we propose, it begins to be a significant change. But I want to focus for you that...
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Jones.
Mr. Long, I thought I heard you say, well, there's the commissioner himself here.
Mr. Longowski, welcome.
Mr. Chairman,
but anyway, you said that you would give insurance status of a department. Now, then you would just include finance in that insurance department, or is it going to be part of that? Maybe you meant the two of them would be the department, but you said that the insurance would have the status of a department.
Let me try it again. In my mind, as I was sort of drawing this out, I think of it as increasing the importance of the regulation of insurance by moving it from division status now in Commerce to department status. But that new department is created from the present Insurance Commissioner's Office and Financial Institutions Division and Workers' Comp.
This has more significance as part of the head of the department concerned than the financial institution.
It might be a clue as to who would be appointed the director of that department.
Could
be a clue.
I just wanted to understand what he was saying.
And even to underscore that a little bit, Representative Jones, we have, although the person would be the director of the Department of Insurance and Finance in our contemplation, I think we would retain the title Insurance Commissioner as well to emphasize the significance of that activity. Now, there's quite a little bit involved in putting the Workers' Comp Department, which is a pretty big department, merging that with two other programs, and I want to talk a little bit about the philosophy of that.
Yeah, well, I would hope that it would go somewhere, and I don't care where.
I'm not sure how to respond to that.
You don't have to.
We suggest that it go from department status, in effect, to division status. And what that'll do, we think, is a couple things. Besides having one person in charge of what is now insurance and what is now workers' comp, and I think that's an improvement, I really do. You'll know who to call for sure. I've been telling the probable insurance commissioner, assuming that's who the governor appoints, that it might be fun to get those phone calls. There's another reason. We have tended, this is maybe just philosophical, but we have tended to look at workers' comp pretty much is a social program. And we've not added to that analysis in my, we as a society, enough of it as an insurance issue and as a business cost issue. I think this does that. I think the debate's going to be a little different now, because I have an idea some of those phone calls to the director of this new department are going to be, why did you approve that rate increase, and why does it still cost so much? I mean, I think the conversation is going to be more complete as a result.
Representative Jones. You could also compliment him when he reduced it and say, well, Mr. Commissioner, you really did fine there. You cut those rates.
I've been telling him that he should offer us, he should claim to have a secret plan he won't reveal until he's in office, but he won't do that.
I'll try not to interrupt you.
No, that's fine. I think it makes the point about as clear as I could make it. Another important thing can be done with this proposal if we can sort of enlist your help. If you recall when I was here with the Financial Institutions Division budget, there isn't any other way to say it but that it was in a lot of trouble. It was broke. And the industry is downscaling, and the program is kind of downscaling behind the industry. And that creates a set of problems for you because you start out with 50 and then pretty soon you're at 40. I think our detail will pull that program down to around 27, 28 people from its present level of 43. And I know Senator Wires and others have looked at me and said, what assurance can you give us that a reduction like that, following on the heels of another reduction, is going to be able to serve the public interest? I mean, I know it's important to focus on cost, but what about their ability to regulate? Well, that's a real good question for somebody who does the kind of work that I do. I mean, that is a very, that's a pointed question to answer. Here's how we propose to answer it. I ask you for some time so our task force could go out and take a look at what's going on, and I gave you a copy of that report some months ago. One of the recommendations of that group of people I assembled and asked to go do the impossible in an impossible time frame was that you find another home, you know, you find a different structure than the Commerce Department where some people are maybe doing related things and administration would get better. In other words, if I'm working on five different programs involving five different topics and they're all dissimilar or disparate, it's a tough management chore. If I'm working on one or two and they're common, the problems are similar, I do a better job and I can do it a little cheaper, particularly over time, particularly if I can cross-train staff and move them from place to place as the need goes up and down. Well, this looked like a terrific opportunity to be able to say to Senator Wires, I can't guarantee it, but I'm close. I know I'm moving in the right direction. What goes on in insurance regulation if we have the kind of law change that some people are urging, so we determine rates before they go into effect instead of after? What goes on is you determine the financial soundness of that insurance company. You take a look at their books. What goes on in FID, in Financial Institutions Division, stripped of all the particulars, it's the same thing. What kind of financial condition is the SNL or the bank or the credit union in? Now, I'm not saying that you could use a bank examiner 3 to examine an insurance company, but I'll bet you that you can use some secretarial help, certainly. We probably all agree with that there's enough common going on. I'll bet you we can use some lower level people or different level people to count cash in both instances or reconcile accounts receivable or do some of the detail work. That possibility, cross-trained staff that you can move, you'd still account for them and make sure the costs are right, plus the ability to develop some paraprofessional staff. To me, the future has got to be, besides using the reports used by other regulators, you know, and streamline the number of things you do and how often you do, to me, this program has to, in time, develop a situation where a person who's paid less than a bank examiner 3 goes out to an institution first and does some days of spade work before the higher paid people come on the scene and make the final judgment. We've got to get there or we're not going to be able to keep up. Well, the way to do that is in a new modern department that has more of that function going on than we do in these two little programs which are now separate. All right.
Senator Wires? Just a quick quick one, not to slow you down very much. What pay range does a bank in San Luis Rey get?
Significant. Yeah, I can back into that number, I think, real quick.
Dollars would be easier.
Well, range would be good, because we've been tracking ranges in Senator Wire's committee, and it's interesting as we compare across functions.
It's a 27. We've got an annual cost for three of them, right?
No, for one.
For one.
That's a biennial cost.
Yeah, a two-year cost of 95,000 plus.
That includes OPE, though.
For one person? Yes. So you would back it out at about 30% fringe and divide by two, 30-some thousand a year.
Thank you.
Are you talking about using lower-paid individuals than those for the initial approach to an institution?
Right. What happens now? We're not there yet, but this is what we're trying to get to. What happens now is every one of these industries, and we've spent a lot of time with them, wants to have people examining their books that are experts in their industry. I understand that, and I'd want the same thing. But that doesn't mean that the person who's in charge of the audit, so to speak, ultimately, that doesn't mean that that person has to do everything upon which their judgment is based. All right. Now, the net effect of this in terms of department structure is if you pull the corporation division out, or excuse me, if you pull the insurance division out and you pull out FID, as I'm proposing, and I've said this to other committees, and I want to say it again to you clearly, that pretty well spells the demise of commerce as you now understand and see it. It's about 580,000 out of the director's office budget, which is a big buy. I just want you to know that in passing, that, and I told the substantive committee, the House Labor Committee, where this bill was, the same thing. You know, understand what you're doing. We've got another bill, 1034, that addresses what happens to those pieces, but that's something to keep in the back of your mind. Now, in doing that, merging the two, mm-hmm. we saved about $1 million in financial institutions division's budget. When we put workers' comp together in the program, and now I want to turn to describing what it looks like, we could do some other savings, because this kind of a department makes some good management sense. We went with a director concept and a deputy director, so that you would have what I call two-in-a-box kind of concept, where you've got a statutory deputy with the powers of the director, a management team, and five divisions. That administrative support division there, shown in the right-hand quarter, represents pulling the management out of these other places and consolidating it. When you do that, and we worked with Jerry Brown and others in doing that, we think we can take seven or eight positions out of workers' comp and abolish them, because it's just a problem of critical size. That administrative support division, which pulls the administration out of all those existing places, can be a little smaller than when it's spread out. Now, you'd say, well, you're going to be saving some money here. No, not really. Because in response to legislative consideration of what I call tort reform issues and workers' comp issues, there's some bills, 323, 2445, and so forth, that propose new duties for the insurance commissioner. We costed those out, and please understand they're an estimate, at about 14 new positions at the cost of about $1 million. We saved about $1.5 million in round numbers, and then we're proposing to spend that savings right back at about $1 million. It may be a little less than that by the time everybody's all done with it. But besides a new administrative machinery, this department, as far as the proposals that's before you, is built on the assumption of new duties. If those measures don't pass, you want to, you know.
Well, we do it the other way in this subcommittee. I don't know how the other subs work, but what we do is identify a budget based on current law, and if you reorganize it, this would be part of the current law. The additional functions, we'd go ahead and expect to be funded out of the e-board, is what we'd do. In other words, we'd assume that bills don't pass, and if they do pass, then we'd roll them in at e-board time. Senator Hannan.
Mr. Long, when you were here previously, there was a substantial deficit on the financial resources.
Yes.
You've indicated there, well, in fact, there may not be that amount of cost savings. Are these other groups then going to be directly or indirectly through some method of subsidizing?
No, there isn't any subsidy other than mutual support, other than combining some support. But the funds remain dedicated. It will be a little more efficient than the Commerce Department, I hope.
Does each one have to stand or fall on their own?
Yes.
That applies to the amount of revenues and the amount of expenditures that are created and go out.
Statutorily dedicated funds.
Well, now, if I could use your analogy there, would the auditor that works in the financial services section be the same auditor to go into an insurance company to look at their records if you're going to share the cost? And how would you break out the dedicated funds to discern when the person is working for financial services, when that person is working for an auditing insurance company?
If I were, that would be ultimately a question for the new director, but there are several methods. The one that I would use, the one I instinctively go to, because I like to do it anyway for other reasons, and first, there are no workload measures available now for a lot of this stuff. What you do is you go to timekeeping, number one. If you will have people keep some kind of time records, whether they're lawyers or doctors or managers or auditors, you tend to collect the data you need to make other decisions. How long does it take to do an audit, et cetera. If you will discipline your folks to do time records of some kind, they don't have to be every 6 minutes like lawyers tend to do, but if you'll do them, then all you have to do is the person's in budget A, for example, but you just do a charge back to the other program for the amount of time spent on the other activity. It's simple, it works, and it's got some fringe benefits. Pretty soon you know the amount of time spent in the other program, and you start adding staff or subtracting, and we could come in here to you for once and say, here are some records that support what we're doing. Right now there aren't any. It's not anybody's fault, that's just the way it is. That's what I do. Now, I don't know, somebody else may want to do something different.
Are you suggesting that's the way to keep funds, say, that are supporting financial institutions separate from funds supporting insurance regulation? Are you suggesting that method?
No, I'm just saying that's the way you start out with cost centers, and you have people committed to programs. When you borrow them, I'm suggesting that when you borrow them, you pay for them out of the other program.
Well, that is a concern. We might as well get right to it. There's a fund created in Section 17 of the bill that's called a insurance and finance fund. And there might be some suspicion, say, on the part of insurance companies who've been reading the paper and saw there's a $1 million problem in the financial institutions division and might worry that their money was going to be used to make up that problem. So there needs to be some way to assure that the funds are accounted for separately, seems to me. Or maybe you haven't heard of that before. Maybe
we've been through it. I met with the industry representatives before we were in draft bill form. We had the concern, and when we discussed it, I met with them privately as well. It was raised in Representative Shipwreck's committee. The bill has the statutory dedication of funds. That sets off a series of administrative consequences. We've gone so far, even though we think the existing draft legislation makes that commitment so that it would be illegal to spend the funds otherwise, we're proposing a further amendment to clarify it even more so that it kind of reads, and we really mean it.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman.
And I think we've satisfied their concerns.
The chairman has mentioned the things being in the newspaper. How much has it been in the newspaper to have financial institutions under this, that you're going to have an insurance and finance department?
I can't answer that.
I try and read the paper every day, but I miss things all the time. I was just wondering, my wife works in one of the downtown business clubs. She hears a lot of remarks, more from Republicans than Democrats. And she heard some pretty choice ones when the new director of the new insurance commissioner was announced. And I'm sorry, this is making kind of a fitting evening for a remark about my mother being a better politician than I am. When they hear that Senator Kulongoski is going to be over the bank, we are going to have to ask for life insurance. They're going to be in the right place. But that's just, I don't expect our invited response. I'm delighted.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to that, because I had served with the Honorable New Commissioner when he was Chairman of the Banking Insurance and Retirement Committee, I believe, back in the 79 session. They called it then Chairman Kulongoski. Requested that I make a motion to send a bill out of committee when I walked into the committee meeting that day, and that the bill was read and it had been properly amended and everybody had agreed to it. So I made the motion to send the bill out. Subsequently, all the members of the committee then voted no. Mr. Broder went through a cardiac arrest in the back of the hearing room. So I think that in all due regard, they, members of the financial community and even the insurance industry, respect our former colleague, and I don't think it's as severe as...
Are you saying that they've had their cardiac arrest now, having survived
it? Yeah, survived. I think they have had their heart palpitations, and those days are over with, and I think that now is the time to know the business at hand.
I think it'd be fair to say to you, too, Senator, I don't read more than about one or two newspapers a day just because of travel time and other things, but I have met with, I think, every known organization in insurance or finance that does any appearing in these halls and explained to them a couple of things. Number one, the appointment of a head of this department, if the legislature sees fit, will be made by the governor, subject to Senate confirmation. If I was a betting person, I'd probably bet that it's going to be Ted Kulongoski, but I don't know that, and only the governor does if he's made up his mind. And number two, I've answered the question directly several times. Is Senate confirmation going to be required? Answer, yes. And number three, I've done something. I haven't unleashed them, you know, to come and do things, but I've asked each of those groups to support this. Some of them had to swallow hard, and some of them had concerns, but nobody has come to me and said, we hate it, we can't stand it, either because of the probable appointee or some other feature. So, I don't know whether the press has reported that or not, but I've been doing it.
Back to your amendments. I think that those go a long ways towards addressing the concerns that we've heard of and are good amendments. I wonder if also it would be consistent with those amendments and acceptable on page 5 of the Andros bill. On lines 15 and 16, we find the words, to the greatest extent possible. I wonder if we could delete those. Because we want to make it real clear, legislative intent would be to make sure that the financing is very specific to the functions for which the funds are extracted and also appropriated.
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible for those that are present, maybe that don't have copies, so that if you could read that?
Oh, okay. Yeah, what the sub 3 says, it says it's the intention of the Legislative Assembly that the performance of the various duties and functions of the department in connection with each of its programs shall be financed, and here are the words, to the greatest extent possible by the fees, assessments, and charges established and collected in connection with those programs.
And the reason why it says to the greatest extent possible is it's one of those arguments that lawyers and accountants love. There will be a penny or a nickel or a dollar that won't make it. And I can remember when the lottery was created and some other things. Lawyers will read that provision in there anyway. but they'll read it in there anyway after you've argued for some hours about 50 cents or some other small amount of money. So you can take it out, but I guess I want you to understand that.
You might be off, you know, a little bit. When you would make a statement of legislative intent, you know, we would say we want it to be appropriate to the function for which the charge is levied. We don't want it to be a very broad guess.
But you understand that you can't do any more than the greatest extent possible. That's
yeah, but we don't want to, in legislative intent, we don't want to say there's a lot of wiggle room here in how you intermingle these funds. We want to say there isn't any wiggle room. And then you're saying, well, we might lose a quarter. I don't know what the largest amount was that you said. I think a quarter was
what I said was it this commits us to do what's possible, and I wouldn't want the negative implication that you were committing us to do the impossible.
We'd never do such a thing.
Maybe we could get that lady that was working for the National Security Council to help us understand it.
Which one was
the one that didn't carry the documents out under her folder?
Oh,
Fun. Oh, yes.
Anyway.
This sounds like a very good way to do it, I think.
And
they,
I think
they
the language.
Good time records. And this is something that's done a lot in government. I don't know if it's. I don't know when I've heard it being done in this exact planned way, but there's an awful lot of that kind of thing done.
Okay.
Now, I want to, I suppose this is just part of our obligation to point out consequences to you. I'd like to spend a half an hour trying to convince you that you ought to help us do this, but there's a couple things that you need to know, or we haven't been candid with you. First of all, as a matter of deliberate policy choice, this director has a great deal of authority over what are now individual programs. We're not duplicating commerce, we're creating a new entity. And we've gone so far as to, in the draft, abolish those existing programs, you know, and move the functions over here, which means the director's power to organize and reorganize and move employees back and forth would be substantial. Not any more than you'd find in any existing well-run program, but more than you'd find in its birthplace. Commerce is a nightmare to run because each thing is statutorily created and each thing is dedicated, and you know, you've got money over here but none over here, and you can't move it even if you account for it. This program is new, modern, streamlined, and the director is given a lot of authority to go with that accountability and responsibility I started out with. So.
That's okay. Yeah.
Can you maybe give us an indication of what licensure boards might be eliminated, or is that going to be spelled out?
Yeah, none here. None are affected here, other than we had a little wrinkle coming out of House Labor. Mm-hmm. Representative Phillips wanted to abolish the banking board, mm-hmm. or to change the appointment process. Mm-hmm. My position was and remains, please don't do anything that's controversial.
Well, why have you got pawn?
Yeah, just.
We're going to get the pawnbrokers. The three of us have been ripped off recently when asked about that.
Yeah.
I'll come to it in a minute, if you'll let me.
Right, three-fourths of this committee has been burglarized in the past month or so. Did you know that?
Excuse me?
Did you know that three-fourths of this committee has been ripped off, burglarized in the last month or so?
If you want to add a little time to that, you just include all of it.
I thought he was going to say somebody come up and stolen some of his tires. After
yeah,
his.
I thought this weekend probably it was his turn because he's
next. He's
next. Yeah. I found some of stuff that was ripped off from us in pawnbroker's shop locally. So the little fences. But we'll get to that anyway.
To finish up the little saga, because you're going to have this question. The House Labor passed a conceptual amendment to this bill, a conceptual amendment, knowing that you would get the question about changing the bank board's appointing process from the governor with Senate confirmation to the director.
What is this?
What I did in response to that was, and I told the committee I was uncomfortable a little bit because I don't want any controversy about this bill. I mean, we spent a lot of time trying to get rid of it, and I didn't want to get an aroused banking board and other people. Well, we kind of got it anyway. I got a letter from everybody on Representative Jolin's committee saying they hate that amendment. I talked to Frank Bronner, who you all know, and said, what do you, you know, what's your organization think about that? And they don't like the amendment either. I would hope, and some of that's in a letter to Senator Thorne from Representative Jolin.
Yes.
And I'm telling you that if you'd make that amendment go away, it would make me happy, for whatever that's worth. I don't want.
Is it in there, Grove?
No, it's a conceptual amendment, whatever that is.
Well, you, what is it?
There's an A and Grove. Oh no, there's a in the printed A and Grove bill. There it is.
All right.
Allows the director of the department to mess with these boards.
I didn't know that they were going
to
do that.
They did that. So under House rules, I have to go to the chairman of the Labor Committee and get him to agree to any amendment that we would make in a substantive piece. So this will be really fun. A first test of those perhaps ill-advised House rules. Anyway, yeah, they went right ahead and did it. Conceptual means they just didn't have it in writing at the time, but they meant to get it in writing between that point
and
this
point. Where do you see it in the summary, Mr.
Chairman? Oh, the boldface material.
I thought that they were. My understanding was, and I, my understanding was that they were not going to do it, until I had a chance to check with the industry and check with some people, because it just popped up at the last hearing.
Try to find it.
If it isn't in there, please don't put it in there.
No, it doesn't give us a nice roadmap.
Why did they want to do that?
I don't know.
I can explain that. I can explain what was said. There are a lot of boards and commissions in commerce now, and when people think about pieces of commerce, they assume that there's a lot of them. There is only one really here, and there is a problem with it. There is a problem with the bank board. It doesn't have enough to do.
There it is. A and Gross bill, page 29, lines 3 through 6. Removes the governor and inserts the director, basically, in terms of the appointing authority.
That's more
conceptual, I think.
That's substantial.
So what's the governor's position on that?
I tried not to bring that subject up to him.
Imagine. Actually, I remind him of the Port of Portland bill. Trade off.
It isn't something we prefer.